talked a bit about attachment style on the Ask Dr. Go podcast, and what I haven't discussed is something called neuroplasticity, because there is a relationship between neuroplasticity and attachment styles. Today on the Ask Dr. Go podcast, I want to discuss how attachment styles can change over time and what the neuroscience is behind that. So stay tuned. Hello and welcome to Ask Dr. Gill. I am your host, Dr. Gill Winkleman. And today on the podcast, we're going to be discussing attachment styles in the context of neuroplasticity. And if you've listened to this podcast before, you know I talk a lot about brain health and mental health and spiritual health. And I think what's interesting is that attachment styles are a really nice way to highlight some of the issues that show up and how the brain does begin to heal itself and rewire itself. And so I think this is an important topic to discuss. So before going deeper, first off, I want to just mention what attachment styles are. And there's different ways of looking at this, but in the context of adult relationships, there's secure, where you're able to engage with someone appropriately, set boundaries, be able to there's more fluidity. You can spend time by yourself, you can spend time with the person, and there's a give and take in that. Anxious people tend to become triggered when they're not with the person, or if they feel the other person is distant. Usually that's an emotional distance, not necessarily a physical distance, although it can be a physical distance as well. And so they get triggered by that. And what happens is their nervous system is on high alert for that happening. And avoidance are kind of the opposite of that. They become on high alert when there's too much closeness, when they spend too much time with someone, where they feel like they don't have enough space. And that also has to do with an emotional issue, but instead of feeling abandoned, they feel flooded. Now, these are kind of two sides of the same coin, but there are definitely differences between the two. And I think it's really important to recognize that this is not a permanent situation for you. So if you grew up and have one or both of those anxious and avoidant, which is called disambiguous, if you have both of those or any of those, either of those, it doesn't mean that you're going to have it forever, because it's interesting that our brains are plastic, if you will. And what I mean by that is that there's an ability to change your brain. And anything you do, in effect, is changing your brain. It's interesting, there's been some articles of late discussing how not reading and spending a lot of time on devices is changing our brains in ways that we don't fully understand yet. And based on test scores in schools, it's probably not a good thing, unfortunately. So, but the flip side is there as well. So if you start reading actual books and you know, doing brain exercises, playing an instrument, whatever it is, those become neuroprotective. Those begin to allow your brain to rewire itself, begin to have higher function. And this is kind of the idea behind neurofeedback. And if you look through some of the old podcasts, I think I have a video, in fact, about neurofeedback, where that is like, in a sense, forcing the brain into changes. Now, where this gets complicated is when we think of neuroplasticity, and I would say that neuroplasticity affects all areas of the brain, but when we think about neuroplasticity, we think about it in terms of learning, right? So we're thinking about it in terms of the areas of the brain where cognition is more of a function. And you might say it's the cerebrum in this particular case. The thing is, and neuroplasticity applies to other parts of the brain, the cerebellum and the limbic brain, which is more of an emotional survival mechanism of the brain. So with the cerebellum, which actually has functions throughout, there's emotional wiring. It's interesting that the cerebellum, which when I was in medical school and in undergrad, it was basically taught that that's for motor coordination, not necessarily big movements, but fine motor skills, although big movements are part of it. So in terms of neuroplasticity, if you learn a new skill, something as like sewing or playing a sport, that's changing your cerebellum. What's interesting is, though, is that research that's come out in the last 15 years, let's say, shows that the cerebellum actually is very important for wiring our ability to process emotions. Now, what does that mean? As an example, kids who don't learn how to do cursive handwriting have a difficulty sometimes interpreting the emotional context around text. I don't mean text messages, I just mean written words, but text messages is one of those. And it's really interesting talking to people who learned cursive in school versus who didn't, and kind of their ability to see through what it is that is being asked or told about things is kind of, I'll say, impaired, for lack of a better way of saying it. And I joke with patients, I'll say, well, this is why we were taught to write in handwriting, "I will not throw spitballs at Susie 500 times. And it's because that wires something within us that is affecting our behavior as well. So it's kind of interesting. Now, let me kind of start to bring this back to the emotional processing, because I think that where we get stuck, and this is part of what the workshop I'm going to be doing, which I'll talk about at the end, where we get stuck is in the stories that we tell ourselves around our reality and in what we perceive as reality. In other words, we identify with, "I'm an anxious attacher," because we have that thought. We come into a situation, a relationship, let's say, and we're looking for what it is to prove that reality from us. And what I'm going to talk about in the second half of the program is how this isn't necessarily a situation that is unchangeable, right? And that's what the research is going to show, that, and it has been showing, that when someone with anxious or avoidance begins to work on this and becomes aware of their tendencies, that's when things can become different and begin to change. Now, one of the interesting things about this is that when you go through kind of books about relationships, I'll say it this way, there's a debate whether, well, do you do this on your own or do you do this with someone else? And the answer is both, really, because it requires the ability, for, as an example, someone who's anxious it's really important for them to learn how to sit with themselves. And I know people who are really good and not very anxious outside of the context of a relationship. But once there's a closeness, that's when they become difficult. That's when it becomes challenging. They're never going to learn how to overcome that without having that experience. And the trick is not to so identify with the experience that you want to be aware of it, right? But you don't want to make it who you are just because that's how you've always been. So, all right, we're going to take a quick break, and I'm going to talk more about this, the ways that you can kind of begin to interweave and change some of this within yourself. So stay tuned. Hello, and welcome back to Ask Dr. Gill. I am your host, Dr. Gill Winkleman. And today we're talking about attachment theory and neuroplasticity. And it's a really interesting piece in terms of embodying the ideas of neuroplasticity. And let me just say that when you are, if you go through this, to understand that this is not an intellectual process necessarily. It's important to know, I might be anxious because of my mom wasn't around when I was a baby and she was sick or whatever it is. That may be important to understand, but intellectually knowing that isn't necessarily going to fix it. And I think this is where a lot of people get tripped up, because I think that knowing that is useful to say, okay, I am triggered now, and then begin to say, I have these tools available to me so I don't have to just react. But to heal it, it's about embodying it. It's about being in your body, literally, and feeling the experience and allowing that to kind of move through you and unwind on its own. And this is why I think in terms of relationships, in terms of healing this style, the attachment style, it's a both. I need to go do whatever it is I'm going to do to begin to bring awareness, and then I have the practice that I would have within the context of the relationship. And it's interesting talking to clients how they evolve. Like in terms of, as an example, there's a woman I work with who has dated a bunch of different men, and who she's choosing is becoming different and over time. And that this is what we talk about, one of the things we talk about. It's not that she is fully healed, because part of the issue is she's not meeting the person who's going to meet her where she wants to be met. But she's recognizing that they can't do that for her. And in terms of the progress, she didn't recognize that with these men before we started working together and the relationships would last longer. And now she's recognizing it really fast, 2-3 dates. And so she doesn't waste her time. She's like, oh yeah, I know that. I got that lesson. And I suspect at some point it's going to become so deeply embedded within her, she's going to recognize it within three sentences as opposed to 3 dates. That's where you're going. And a lot of the work that we do is helping her sit with what it is she's experiencing in her body. And this is, if you're able to have a relationship with someone who's secure and just sit with them, that begins to calm your nervous system. And it takes time, right? This is part of the trust building process that goes on in relationships in general. But being able to have consistency, you have repeated experience of healthy interactions, healthy attunement, healthy co-regulation. And over time, this becomes more ingrained, if you will, within your nervous system. And I know I've talked about this in other shows, but being able to sit or stand with someone and give them a hug for a minute or more is something that helps. If you just give a quick hug, there's no nervous system signal that happens. Whereas if you do it for 60 seconds or more, I think some of the research is 20 seconds, but I think 60 seconds is a good amount. What happens is that your nervous system begins to calm down. That's the experience. And this is also important for people who are avoidants, who are more likely to push someone away right away, right? Because there's that, I can't do this experience, that angsty, I need to get away, feeling. And as you kind of sit with that and are aware of it, it dissipates. And, part of this may be, as I'm thinking about this, it may be closer to 2 minutes. And the reason I say that is that generally, most emotions move through us with awareness and not holding on in 90 seconds. That's how long emotions stick around in the body. In terms of the nervous system, right? Now, our minds, our brains might think about the experience, and then that will keep it moving, right? And this is sort of the balance in trauma work often. In terms of trauma therapy, is how do you help someone experience the emotion without dredging things and re-experiencing it, reworking it over and over again? So one thing I will say, it's not about pretending either. You're not pretending you're not hurt. You're not saying that the past didn't happen. What you're saying is my past doesn't have to be my present. And it's important to understand that. Everything in the world is a reflection of the way we see the world. That is a spiritual truth in my mind. It's not necessarily how it is. It goes back to, there's an old story in Hinduism or Buddhism is 4 blind men hanging onto an elephant. And basically, they don't know it's an elephant. And one says it's a rope. Well, he grabbed the tail. And one says, no, it's a tree. Well, he grabbed the leg. And it's like neither of those perspectives is necessarily wrong. It's just incomplete. And as you grow and become aware and see that, you see your own filters, you see your own lenses, these things begin to change. And it's powerful. And then your brain begins to see things differently. Here's another example. There's these images that are, there's one in particular I'll describe, but there's multiple images like this, where if you look at it one way, It's one image. And if you look at it another way, it's another image. And when you first look at it, you might see two lovers face to face. And then you kind of keep looking and your perspective change and you see a chalice. Both are there. Both are true. And then you kind of, can you see them both at the same time? Which is really interesting. Is that possible? That's another debate, another topic. So practically, like, how do you go about this? And this is where I think therapy is super important, because I think that without that, you, depending on where you're at in the process, but without it, you don't understand necessarily where the wounding is and what the wounding is and what your actions are. And that's where a therapist, and this is, and I'm talking talk therapy here for a minute. It could be relational therapies, trauma-informed therapies, attachment-based therapies. It's about understanding the mechanisms, the triggers, your responses, because so many people aren't aware of that. Honestly, I think it's everybody in particular situations. And what's interesting is so many people go into freeze in a way. They shut down and they don't necessarily know they're shutting down. And so this is where a therapist can be really helpful, kind of pointing that out. Now, that by itself does not fix it. And this is where maybe somatic work, mindfulness, somatic re-experiencing, Hakome, Feldenkrais, Alexander technique. These are therapies that are helping people get into their bodies more. A yoga therapy. The body work brings awareness to how things are and how we hold on to things, where our guarding is, where openness is, how to open more. Those are really important, so that when you go into a relationship with someone else, that can be corrective. And it's very important to find people who are emotionally consistent and bring signals of safety to your nervous system. Now, there's a caveat here that I would say, which is signals of safety and signals of familiarity are not the same thing. And oftentimes we feel quote unquote safe when we're with someone who is familiar, even if that familiarity is abusive. And I think that this is, again, this is where body work, this is where therapy is really, really important. So if you come from a place of either you've been in abusive relationships or you were abused as a child, and it is important to understand that there is a rewiring that will happen and needs to happen for you to have that sense of true safety. So, and then understanding that no one's perfect and old triggers are going to come to the surface. And hopefully, in terms of interpersonal relationships, you're with people who you feel safe enough to have a discussion. You feel that your ability to engage with someone is there, that in such a way that you feel safe to express what it is that's going on and come back and heal. One of the things John Gottman, who's in his institute, has just been phenomenal in terms of understanding relationships and so forth, talks about, like, one of the most, if not the most important aspect of longevity of relationship is the ability to come back together after a fight. And until you do that, and it's like everything's a honeymoon before that, and then you have that fight and it feels awful. And the reality is if you can come back together and heal from that, then you have a place where there's more of a foundation of, wow, this is real, right? And so, and then, you know, understanding, I'll just reiterate, having self-compassion in this, knowing that no one's perfect, you're going to make mistakes, and the rewiring is going to take time. So, all right, so that's what I got for you today. I hope this was really enjoyable, and I will mention my workshop. I will be doing a workshop in January, most likely, which will talk about how to rewire your stories around, and specifically around health, but it can be around anything. And I have written multiple blog posts about this. You can check that out on the Ask Dr. Gill website, askdrgil.com. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to send me an email at info@askdrgill.com. And if you like this show, please give me a good review or click follow down below on YouTube or wherever you might be watching this. It helps to spread the word, and I enjoy putting this out and would like to feel like it's actually hitting more and more people. So thanks again for tuning in, and I will talk to you next time.